So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of the Media Twits is sponsored by the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, which is accepting applications for its entrepreneurial journalism programs. Get more details at bit.ly/CUNYJSchool. That's bit.ly/CUNYJSchool. And joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing, Rafat?
Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Good. How about you?
Good, good. Just now that September is over and October is starting, things are picking up, and it's been a busy last couple of weeks for us.
Yeah. Have you guys hit any milestones at Skift at your startup? I saw you were at the Paley Center with a bunch of other startups.
Yeah, we presented. They had a startup showcase. As my first, or I guess our company's first public pitch. Not pitch. It was not a competition per se, but pitch showcase or whatever. So which went well. I think it's good practice for us to go out and keep talking. I mean, ours is a media company, so it's not. You know, the most of the startup pitch things are more like. The more product, like app-based stuff or like products that you can play around with, is stuff to show a website. Oh, here's a website. There's sections in the site. It has news. It has this. It has that. And since we're still early in the product cycle, it's a little it's different than the usual product-based things that get demoed at conferences. Or
yeah, it's not as sexy as like an app or something, you know, a website that's going to change the whole world.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we think we're going to change our world in ways that will be very interesting, but we'll start early in the process. But it's not a very traditional product pitch. It's an interesting experience.
I can imagine. And we're going to actually have a mixer at the Paley Center October 23rd, the one in New York, where you are after the Pointer kind of ethics conference is happening that day. We're going to do something from 5 to 7. So I haven't even been to the Paley Center yet, so I'm kind of excited to just check it out.
Yeah. No, I've been very close to the Paley Center people, and I like them a lot. Their space is really nice, very central. They're very connected in the big media space, and now increasingly in the startup space as well, especially in the intersection of media and tech. And so certainly will be good for you, and of course I'll be there for your event as well as certainly I'll be there for your mixer.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, New York is such a great place for the intersection of media and technology, like you said. So having a place that people can meet and talk and have these kind of talks and discussions is great, just to bring people together.
Yeah. So what are we discussing on the show today?
So today we'll talk about, you know, last night social media was completely abuzz with the presidential debate, the first presidential debate that happened last night. And of course it was experienced in new ways online, so much live streaming going on. We're going to talk to Christopher Price from Tumblr. Tumblr had a live GIFing of the debates. And we'll also Bill Allison from the Sunlight Foundation. The Sunlight Foundation did a live kind of fact check and background as far as the money involved in the debate and involved in each subject of the debate. And then we'll talk about the challenges of mobile advertising. Mobile usage is now bigger than ever, especially with news consumption. And now there's so much opportunity for mobile advertising, but a lot of the ads have kind of fallen short. Publishers haven't really been able to charge very much for those ads. Most of them are kind of annoying. People accidentally swipe them or click them by accident. So we'll talk to Joe Laszlo from the IAB, which helps set standards for ads. We'll also talk to Jason Del Rey from AdAge, who just did a big story about online mobile advertising. And we'll also talk to Chetan Sharma, who has done consulting for a lot of mobile firms and is very conversant in mobile. Mm-hmm. So first we'll talk about the presidential debates and how they've extended into digital in so many ways this year. You know, imagine a day in the past when presidential debates were held and no one knew what happened until a newspaper came out the next day. Now the debates are not only live streamed all over the web, but also fact-checked in real time and even live gift by Tumblr and The Guardian. Is it distracting or does it add something to the experience? Our guests are Christopher Price, editorial director of Tumblr. He's created 178 Tumblogs, including his main one, Topher Chris. He's been with Tumblr since 2009 and will be involved in a new outlet composed entirely from Tumblr stories. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
And we also have Bill Allison, who's the editorial director for Sunlight Foundation Reporting. Bill has spent the better part of his career reporting on lobbyist influence in Washington, campaign finance transparency, and earmarks. He's a veteran investigative reporter and editor. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
So, Chris, let's start with you. We heard a lot about this kind of live GIF idea. Animated GIFs were something kind of at the dawn of the internet that have now kind of come back in a way and become super popular, something that people share online a lot. What was the idea behind doing this, and how did you think it was received?
Well, it all started as really as just this was going to be an experiment. As you mentioned, GIFs are very old technology. The GIF format was invented 25 years ago, but in the last 2 years or so, I'd say, there's been a real resurgence in GIF artists and using the format to actually make artistic expression and even political expression. So we thought that Tumblr would be a perfect place to bring these types of artists together. The internet at large and Tumblr is filled with just so many individuals that don't want to just take in their culture. They want to remix it. They want to add back into it. And so really it was just an experiment. We thought, you know, what better place to bring some GIF artists together? We got them in the same room at the Tumblr office, and it turned into a big event. We invited some friends, and they invited some friends, and at the end of the day, we had a GIF session of logic in the debate, in addition to a debate watching party in the office. So it was a really cool event at the end.
Do you think it added something to the debate itself or to the way people can experience it? I mean, some people said it didn't add a lot of substance necessarily, but I mean, it was kind of an entertaining way to look at things or a way to just kind of on the fly have reactions to it. What did you think about that?
What I think it's best for is when, if you're watching the debate and you're watching it on television and you just want some other information to go along with that. You know, we didn't want these GIFs to try to, obviously they don't replace, real journalism or interpretation of what actually happened in the debate, but we felt like this would be an entertaining, new way for people to experience debates who our younger users, maybe have never even watched a presidential debate before. And if this gets some people interested in the process, I consider that a success.
That makes sense. So, Bill, tell us about the Sunlight Live experience. You know, last night it was interesting to follow your stream. You had a lot of experts that were online, and as, you know, different subjects came up in the debate, you guys would kind of do links to, you know, who had donated to the candidate on a specific issue. Is this something you've done before, and was this, you know, what was your response last night?
Yeah, this is something we've done before. This began with the healthcare summit that President Barack Obama had when they were after the election of Scott Brown, when he brought together Republican leadership, Democratic leadership to discuss the Affordable Care Act. And what we did then is we had a room full of people. We did a lot of research beforehand. So when somebody starts talking about a CBO scoring or an estimate, we could point to that. We had pre-prepared data so that we could show the contributions from healthcare industry to individual members who are talking about the healthcare industry. And for the debates, we really tried to do exactly the same sort of thing, do a lot of background research and point out to, if somebody's mentioning a study from the Tax Policy Center, we could, you know, show a link to it, or if somebody's discussing a particular plan for reforming entitlements, or the Paul Ryan budget, or the Bowles-Simpson plan, we can, you know, point to those things. And we really don't do fact-checking live. What we prefer to think of it as is we provide additional context, so that if there is, and sometimes we have a lot of audience participation, and if we can get viewers to ask us questions, sometimes we can answer them, and sometimes we can just point them to the right place to go to get the answers to the questions they have.
So this is Rafa. I have a question which is somewhat related, but maybe not. But because you mentioned fact check, do users, as they're following the live debate, does fact checking even matter? Because the reality is, most people know that these debates are heavily scripted, and of course aimed at the 5 undecided voters that are there. Does live fact checking even add anything to the debate?
Yeah, I think there's a slightly different issue, and at least from our perspective, and it's that a lot of what presidential candidates are talking about in this kind of a forum, and we've done fact-checking type things where we've got a committee hearing and a witness is talking about something and saying that, you know, and there is a checkable fact. But when you have President Obama saying that it's a $5 trillion tax cut and Mitt Romney saying it's not a $5 trillion tax cut, and as we pointed out last night, Mitt Romney does not have a plan that you can fact check. It's nothing that's been submitted to the Congressional Budget Office. It's not, you know, but a lot of it, you know, when you're talking about, when Barack Obama was talking about 100,000 new teachers, I mean, how do you fact check intentions? I mean, you just can't do that. So, but what we try to do is give the context and the other information around it. And I do think that's useful for people to hear. And I think it's also useful for them to get a sense of, and there are, you know, there are a few times when, for example, when they're talking about the cuts to Medicare that are created by the Affordable Care Act, and we were able to point to some fact-checking resources on that. So sometimes that can be useful. But, you know, one of the things, though, that I think that for us was most frustrating about covering an event like this is that, you know, both Mitt Romney and Barack Obama were spitting out statistics one after the other.
Right.
We had commenters saying, you know, fact-check, 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 and nobody can type fast enough to keep up with that number of claims. So what we really think is more valuable for doing is providing perspective and context rather than saying this is true and this isn't true.
Chris, what did you think about, I noticed in following some of the social feeds, you know, the whole comment about Big Bird and PBS and, you know, Mitt Romney saying, you know, I'm going to have to cut the subsidy to PBS. Sorry, Jim Lehrer. But I like Big Bird. And so there was all these kind of Twitter feeds that came out, you know, fired Big Bird became a big popular Twitter feed. And there was a lot of talk about PBS. I mean, did you see some other entertaining stuff out there during the debates and shortly thereafter?
Yeah, in fact, we had a couple of Big Bird related GIFs come out of our team, you know, right in the office that night, and others across Tumblr that we reblogged to our Tumblr blog for this. And that sort of zing, if you will, you know, it's just sort of the perfect thing to make a quick visual of, to point out something like that happened in the debate. I'm looking forward, though, to GIFs evolving to the point where GIFs can actually help within the fact-checking process as well, but that's maybe a bit of an evolution.
I mean, the there were "I love coal," "I love teachers." He had like 6 of those lines he had there, which were just so GIF-worthy, I guess, if that's the word. I don't know what the word is. And then, I mean, the reality is debates, if you were to turn off everything else and just sit and watch the debates, they have to be the most boring thing you can ever imagine. But Turn on Twitter, turn on all the other stuff, whether it's fact check, whether it's context, whether it's live GIF or anything else, and then it's a lot more entertaining and fun. I mean, nobody is going to gain enough knowledge out of these debates to then decide, oh, I'm going to vote for this candidate, or at least very few of us will. And so at minimum, they're there for their entertainment value, and I think Twitter and all these other things just enhance it to another level.
Yeah, I would say so too, that I think that a lot of the value of it is providing a richer experience for people who want to interact with the event rather than just passively sit there and soak it all in.
Do you think there's been some kind of criticism about the debates not kind of being as interactive as they could. I know that some of the primary debates in the past had, YouTube questions being asked, and, the audience gets involved, and there's a lot more kind of feedback loop that's actually put into the debate. Do you think the debate commission might consider doing something with a little bit more audience interaction? I know there's been town halls in the past, but we haven't seen those as much lately. Bill, do you think that would be something that might help the debates, at least make them a little bit more interesting?
Well, I definitely think that it could, but I think the thing you have to remember on the about the Commission on Presidential Debates is that it is run, really for the benefit of the two political parties, and I think that it's not a perfect vehicle for doing this because of, just the fact that the parties want to keep control of the message and as much as possible, and I think this is why the primary debates are so much more freewheeling and there's so many different formats. Because it's not, something that's set up by the party. It's news organizations. It works a lot of times working with either universities or other nonprofits, and they can, pull together a lot of different interesting, innovative formats. And I think that if the debate commissions, if we get a second group doing debates for presidential candidates, maybe have a one showcase the way that the Commission on Presidential Debates wants it, and a couple other showcases from other groups, that would be a much better process.
How do we make sure that the moderators are better? I mean, compared to last night.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about moderator, and also just even the way they chose the moderators. I think that also, I'm guessing, was something that had a lot of input from the campaigns, and wasn't necessarily any kind of media input.
Well, that was one thing I think that I was really thinking about, though, about how we choose the moderators, because moderating a debate is not really one of the skill sets that you learn in journalism school or that you learn on a beat in journalism or even learn as a broadcaster.
Right.
And it's a very different format. And I wonder if you need a different kind of person, maybe a referee from the NFL or an umpire from baseball to call the make the calls.
Definitely. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us. I really appreciate
Oh,
it.
my
Thank you for
pleasure.
having me.
So now let's talk about the challenges of mobile advertising. Everyone believes the future of media, news, and information will be mobile, whether on smartphones, tablets, or future devices that look like a combination of both. What about the future business models on mobile? So far, mobile ads have grown strongly, but many people feel they're more intrusive. And Mary Meeker recently reported that the effective CPMs, or cost per thousands, that mobile ads can get are just 75 cents compared to $3.50 on desktop computers. How can that change? Our special guests are Joe Laszlo, Senior Ed Director of the Interactive Advertising Bureau's Mobile Marketing Center of Excellence. Joe manages many of the IAB's mobile standardization, best practices, and research projects. Prior to the IAB, Joe had an 8-year tenure at Jupiter Research, where he started researching and writing about mobile interactivity in 2000. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you very much.
We also have Jason Del Rey, reporter at Advertising Age, where he writes about digital media and advertising technology. He was previously the senior reporter at Inc. Magazine, where he wrote about startups and other fast-growing, privately held companies across all industries. You can follow him on Twitter at Del Rey. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Chetan Sharma, founder and president of Chetan Sharma Consulting. He's a recognized industry expert in strategy and implementation of wireless data and pervasive computing solutions. He served as an advisor to senior executive management of several Fortune 100 companies in the wireless space. He's probably the only strategist to have advised each of the top six global mobile data operators. Welcome to the show, Chetan.
Thanks, Mark.
So, Jason, recently wrote a story on Ad Age, really looking at the challenges that are facing the mobile advertising business. Now, more and more people are using mobile to get their news. There was a recent report from Pew about that. But while so many people are going onto mobiles, going onto their phones and tablets to read the news, they're not really seeing as much advertising, and the advertising that they're seeing is basically just repurposed from the web. Is that what you found in your story?
So in my story, I focused specifically specifically on how media companies are dealing with advertising and trying to monetize their audiences, specifically on mobile phones, because the challenges there are much different and perhaps greater than on tablet computers, for example. So the screen size, of course, is an initial challenge. Having advertisers trying to get a message across on a device that's with a small screen and feels pretty intimate without really, really annoying the user and the user experience is tough. And also with the advent of the app stores and all these mobile games, you see the inventory supply on mobile phones for advertising increase rapidly, and the media companies and the big brand advertisers weren't necessarily ready for that. And so what you see, what you've seen over the last couple of years are supply far outstripping demand, and so that's a reason for some of the low prices. And so media companies are frankly struggling with trying to make money on these devices while their users use them more and more to consume news and information. You have the New York Times, who's able to charge some subscriptions for their digital service. Couple that with advertising to sort of build a nice business, but others who don't have the luxury of having the New York Times brand are still trying to figure it all out.
And Joe, you're at the IAB, and part of the issue, I think, is that we have these kind of, a lot of people will just take ad formats or ads that they see on the web and try to just basically make them smaller but replicate them on mobile. What are you guys doing to help kind of create more, something that's a little bit more innovative or a little bit, I guess you could call mobile native, when it comes to advertising, something that actually works on mobile that doesn't, I guess, bother people, but it feels like it's something that they might want or be more relevant to their experience?
Right. I think that's a great question and a key issue for the industry. And the IAB, as one of the bodies that helps set standards and establish best practices for the industry, is playing a leading role helping to make that wave of improvement in mobile advertising happen on a couple of fronts. Earlier this year, we released a set of standard ad formats that we call the Mobile Rising Stars. And these are five new ad types designed very specifically with smartphone and tablet screens in mind to look good and perform well and be fun and engaging in that mobile environment in a way that a repurposed basic banner ad that just kind of sits there and hopes that the user might click or tap on it can't be. And so I think as we start to see media companies start to build these new standard ad formats into their mobile apps and mobile websites, hopefully we'll see the overall ad experience improve. Of course, a standard ad format is just a blank canvas, really, and kind of how good the advertising really is really depends a lot on how well the advertising agencies, the companies that build the ad messages that use the ad units to tell a story, embrace and learn to do that in mobile. And I think that education piece is another thing that everybody in the industry is working hard on. It's not just the ads in terms of their look and their size need to be better, but we also need to know how to convey the right message to a consumer on a mobile device.
And Shayton, do you want to jump in and talk about what you're seeing from kind of the mobile companies themselves? They have, obviously gained from having so many more users now. Are they in some way working on some of how the advertising works, trying to standardize things so that, let's say, an advertiser doesn't have to do a different type of ad for every single mobile platform? Is there something that's going on the mobile industry side of this?
Yeah, I think I think if you step back, the promise of mobile advertising has always been that you connect the impressions to revenue and be able to help the user navigate towards something that they would want to purchase on impulse. And so we have seen, you know, I think as previously mentioned, we have seen this tremendous growth in the number of impressions, but it hasn't been really correlated with the increase in revenue. While the revenue has increased, it's not correlated. It's, you know, probably 1/10 or 1/20 of the number of impressions that have come into the marketplace. So, A, I think the industry is working towards helping the brands and the agencies understand that you could, through metrics and through relevancy and targeting, provide ads in such a way that it can connect to a transaction beyond just an impression. And when you do that, you see results. So I think we are seeing some of that in the earlier incarnations of couponing and ads that lead to offers and so on and so forth. And companies like Expedia, as well as Fandango, who are transaction companies, are seeing benefits of advertising where you can connect an impression to an actual sale.
One of the other thoughts that, again, I'm trying to look at what are the other trends that are happening across across online and mobile. I mean, the another one is responsive design, which a lot of people are talking about right now, speaking of Atlantic and others, that essentially, and we talked about it in our last show as well, I'm wondering from an IAB perspective, are the ad units that are then being built can play across all kinds of devices that sort of incorporate the responsive design philosophy? I wonder if that's happening in the industry.
Absolutely. We are definitely beginning to see a lot of interest in responsive design as a solution to the key industry challenge, which is one of fragmentation, I guess you could say, you know, fragmentation of different device operating systems, different screen sizes and screen resolutions, all of which make it very, very hard to build ads, to create ads where you know, with a minimum of effort you can create one piece of creative, tell one story of an advertiser and have it run across all of the diverse mobile screens out in consumers' hands. So I think there's a lot of interest in responsive design as a solution to make it easier both to create content for mobile devices that can intelligently change the way it's laid out and which content elements are chosen to be displayed depending on, again, the screen and the device that a consumer is using. I mean, you can do a very similar thing with the advertising piece as well, where an ad can potentially intelligently change its size and shape and which specific elements of the overall ad go into a given advertising opportunity, again, based on the screen and the device that the ad is showing up on. The IAB just released a short research paper looking at the topic of responsive design in the last week or so, and I think, you know, the bottom line coming out of that is this is potentially a great tool, but it is only a tool. And I think some people are maybe, you know, kind of looking at it as more than a tool, like it's some kind of miracle, holy grail solution to all of the industry's problems. And so I think as long as we're clear-headed about the fact that it is a tool and it's going to take, you know, experts who know how to use it to really take advantage of what it can do, I think responsive design will lower costs and hopefully deliver better ads and better content more easily and quickly.
What about the concern that, you know, Jason brought up early on, which was, you know, there's this when you're using, let's say, a mobile phone, it's a very kind of personal device, or we're used to it being as something very personal, and an ad intrusion, let's say you're you know, going online, you're looking for some information, and you might have this kind of full page or kind of screen takeover, which I know USA Today is kind of building into their responsive design. Is that something that people are just going to have to get used to, or is there a better way to kind of be contextual but not be too intrusive?
I think from the IAB's perspective, there's going to be different solutions that are suitable in different contexts, and so I think the industry will slowly learn that you know, a successful mobile ad campaign is going to have to take a bunch of different things into account. Certainly the device that the user's on and what the user happens to be doing, as well as, you know, what that person's likes and dislikes are and maybe even where they happen to be. But I think, you know, the shortest answer to that question is the full screen interruptive type of mobile ad can work really, really well in some contexts, in a magazine or even a newspaper type setting. I think that's great, but I don't think that's going to be universally the case. And I absolutely believe that if a consumer is more in the mindset or the mode that they just need one piece of information very, very quickly from their mobile device, then that sort of interruptive ad is not an optimal solution. And you need to be looking for something that's more, again, to your point, contextual or integrated into the experience, not as interruptive.
I mean, I think my view is that the mobile ads need to be contextual, but not creepy. I mean, once you kind of cross the line, you lose that customer probably forever. And I don't think industry has done a terrific job of giving privacy control back to the consumer, where he or she can say, for any given amount of time, I want to see ads from XYZ, but not from others, as well as it's becoming increasingly difficult for the consumers to understand which apps or which websites are collecting what information. It's only after something gets to the press or something blows up that consumers find out. So I think there needs to be more transparency about what kind of data is collected and how it's used, and an ability for the ecosystem to reverse back something. So for instance, if one partner is collecting data and is giving to the third party, there should be an ability that is provided to the consumer where they can say, I want to withdraw my data from this app, and it should flow back to third parties as well. Right now, there is no kind of linkage between, it's only one-way street. The data goes out, but data cannot be deleted from third parties. So I think there are a number of issues that need to be addressed from a privacy perspective before consumers truly become, truly embrace it. And these technologies and solutions need to also realize and be able to address the whole spectrum of privacy concerns, from consumers who really don't care about privacy to the other extreme who are very, very concerned about privacy. And so we have generally seen very generic privacy solutions, not something that scales across the spectrum.
Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate you joining us.
Sure, you're welcome. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our sponsor, CUNY J School. Learn more about their entrepreneurial program at bit.ly/CUNY J School. I want to thank my co-host, Rafat Ali, as well as our guests, Christopher Price, Bill Allison, Joe Laszlo, Jason Del Rey, and Chetan Sharma. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to keep up with all the news, polls, and information at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift, and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab, and our third site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.